What I wanted to do this session is something, a new exploration for me, actually, not totally new. Something I've been exploring for some time now, and this will be just the first time I've really spoken about it in public or to anybody, really. So this is sort of, I've been putting together my thinking around Buddha's Four Noble Truths, what he meant by that. And just, I've been looking at sort of a different understanding, which I think I was a more sort of, more in line with, I think, where, you know, non-duality is taking us today in our thinking. And the traditional idea of Buddha's teaching, this is the very, not traditional, this is the very conventional, superficial idea. I read saying this, or was on a site somewhere recently, you know, Buddha said, life is suffering, we have to put up with it, and it's all our own creation. And, you know, that's a very superficial, somewhat sort of New Agey view that, you know, we create reality. If you're sick, it's your fault. You know, if you've lost your job, it's your fault. If you're injured, it's your fault. You know, it's like, I don't go along with that at all. But that's the very sort of, that's the most superficial thing. But it's, you know, it's a common idea that's out there by people who haven't really looked at Buddhism at all. Buddha, just to briefly recap his story and how he came to his Four Noble Truths, because I think it's, you know, probably quite a few of you know it, but for those who don't, he was born a rich prince, had everything he needed, you know, great food, service, opportunity, you know, he had a wonderful, wonderful life. But he just realized he was still not happy. And as he put it, still suffering, still not happy. And so he left home. He left everything, went out on the road, became the first wandering hippie. Well, not the first, maybe, but left everything, just went out on the road, left his home, family, in search for, you know, the way to end suffering. And he spent 6 years traveling around, studied with probably some of the best teachers around, which at that stage were few and far between. Remember, India at that stage was really, the spiritual teachings were all about ritual, obeying the gods, that sort of stuff. The idea of the self and the Upanishads was only just beginning to creep in, and they were called the forest teachings. So he was out there looking for the forest teachings and studied with these people. It ended up with the idea that you've got to give up everything. He'd already given up home and everything, but it got to the stage where he was giving up eating. You know, there's hardly eating anything at all. I mean, it is said, who knows, he had one grain of rice a day. I can't believe that. But anyway, he gave up everything, emaciated, nearly dying. And then came this realization, and that, you know, basically a healthy mind and a healthy body. And so he started eating again and sat in meditation under this tree and had his awakening, which was really, it's not about giving up things in the world, renunciation of things, but it's, as he put it, giving up clinging to ideas and beliefs, really about what will make us happy. But it was about giving up clinging was his realization. It's a mental thing. We need to give up a mental thing. And he was excited by this. And I think, you know, most people who wake up are excited by their discovery. Ah, you know, this is what it's about. And he rushed off to find six of his fellow travelers who'd been traveling around together, visiting the various teachers, and they were sitting in a park. And the story goes, at first they were sort of really annoyed with him because he'd clearly been eating and not doing what they were meant to be doing. But then he told them, and this is what the Four Noble Truths are said to be, is the truths he told them upon meeting him, upon his awakening. And noble is an interesting word here, because we think of noble, you know, in our culture, you know, either it's the old idea of a nobleman, an aristocratic person, but also, you know, we think of noble as somebody who, you know, does something good, or you would say, oh, that was very noble of you. That was very, you know, very noble of you. We use it in that sense as well. What the word actually means, the Pali word, Pali was the language he spoke, which is actually very close to Sanskrit. But the word noble there meant somebody who had awakened, somebody who was awake or had tasted awakening. But basically it meant a wise person. A noble person was a wise person. And so, and he was somebody who, you know, awakened. And so this, so the Four Noble Truths were basically the truths as seen by a wise person. And I think that that's an important context for all this. And the first noble truth was the truth of suffering. And the word that was used there was dukkha, D-U-K-K-H-A. We don't want to worry about spellings. Dukkha, which actually is a negation. It's a negative of the word sukha. And sukha means to be at ease, to be content. So dukkha means not feeling at ease, not feeling content. So that's what he was meaning by suffering, not sort of abject pain, you know, what we think of as real suffering. He just meant discontent, not feeling happy, not feeling at ease. And he was saying, we all feel that. And I think that's something we can all relate to. I think most of us probably spend a lot of our time feeling discontent at one thing or another. And his realization was that a lot of that discontent is actually self-created. And there's actually a deeper meaning to dukkha, which is the word sukha, from which it's derived. The word sukha means literally good, whole, and it referred to the whole inner wheel, the axle hole in a wheel. Because when you think about it, the wheel was, you know, the great technology of the time. It changed everything with transport and everything. So a wheel needed to have a good hole in order to not run smoothly, there'd be no resistance. So dukkha means a wheel with a bad hole, which means it's not running smoothly, there's resistance. And that's what he saw, you know, the resistance was, that's led to the clinging of really not accepting what is. There's a phrase, I mean, I think many of us heard today, these days, is, you know, pain is inevitable, suffering is optional. And what that refers to is, yes, we get pain, we're going to have pain, it's inevitable. The suffering is more the resistance to the pain, it's not accepting the pain. And the way the Buddha illustrated this was, you know, he was saying, you know, we get stabbed by, I think he said an arrowhead or something. We stab ourselves an arrowhead, that causes pain. And then we give ourselves a second stab, and that's the suffering. So it's like the suffering is added discontent over the pain that's there. And then his second noble truth was, you know, what is the cause of this discontent that we all experience? And this is where clinging came in. The second noble truth is that we cling to ideas of, basically we cling to ideas of what we think will make us happy. And this is something we talked about in, I think, previous sessions. You know, basically, the fundamental motivation, the bottom line of everything we do is that we want to be happy. We want to be content. We want to be at peace. Whatever we do, maybe convoluted, but the back of it is we think in some way or another we'll feel better for this. And this feeling better is what I call the natural state of mind. Feeling good is our natural state of mind. And if everything is okay in the world, there's no problems, there's no threats, there's nothing we need to take care of, we feel good inside. When there's something that needs taking care of, then we naturally feel discontent. We want to do something about it. So the natural state of mind is one of contentment. And that's what we're looking for, in a way, to return to the natural state of mind in everything we do. We want to return to that state of ease, that state of contentment. And what we get caught in our society, and I think probably most societies, I mean, I just know our society, Western society, but I think probably all societies through history, we get caught in this idea that if we're not happy, we have to do something about it. We have to change something. We have to act. And that sort of runs through our culture. At times it's very, you know, it's very important. There's things we do need to do in the world. But a lot of the time, that's just coming from some some imagined need. We imagine, we start thinking about, you know, what's going to happen tomorrow? Do I need to do this? We start creating discontent, and then we try to resolve that discontent by doing something. Or we're feeling low, so we go and whatever it is, go to the movies, have some more coffee, eat some more food. But that's the basic sort of belief system, really, that runs our culture. And that is what creates a lot of discontent. And the irony of all this is we're looking for happiness. We're looking to feel content, whatever word you want to give it. I sometimes just use the word okay. We're looking to feel okay. And so much of our thinking about how we are going to be okay, what's going to make us feel okay, stops us feeling okay. It creates discontent. In a strange way, the way we're looking to end suffering, we want to be happy, we're looking to end suffering, and we get caught in all these ways that actually create suffering. And I sort of think this is sort of almost a sad joke about human beings. We want to be at peace, we want to end suffering, and yet we, in our attempts to do that, we're just creating more and more suffering and tension. Then the third noble truth was the truth of the end of suffering. And the word there is interesting. It's, in his language, it's nirodha. This I find fascinating because this word is key to Patanjali's Yoga Sutras as well. And it's often translated as ceasing. And it's a sort of fairly good interpretation word, is ceasing. In the Yoga Sutras, and it's almost that this is so parallel to what Buddha's teaching, the Yoga Sutras start saying yoga is the ceasing of the whirling of mind stuff. And I translate yoga not as getting unified with something, but the end of separation, the end of our separation, the internal separation of inside us, the division, the duality, the end of that duality, that is yoga, comes from the ceasing of the whirling of mind stuff. The whirling of mind stuff is our thoughts whirling around. What if, oh, that's good, that's exciting, I shouldn't have done that, whatever. That's the whirling of mind stuff. And the way that was traditionally interpreted, you've got to stop it. Ceasing means you have got to stop it. You've got to control it. And that's gradually giving away these days to a realization, no, it's about allowing it to cease. In fact, the word nirodha literally means not sprouting. It's to cease sprouting. And so that's why in my approach to meditation, which is similar to some others, it's about not trying to stop thoughts, not trying to stop the whirling of mind stuff. But when you realize you're caught in a thought, just not following it, not following that particular thought that comes up. So by not following it, we're basically returning, we're coming back, we're returning to ourselves, returning to being, or returning closer to that. And I think that is, in a way, the real renunciation is not renouncing things in the world, it's more saying, I'm not going to follow that thought. When a thought comes up, it's choosing to say, I'm not going to follow that, because that's just going to lead to more discomfort, more discontent. I'm not going to follow that thought. And that I think is probably one of the most fundamental choices we have, is the choice not to follow a given thought, given idea. And that's what I call the ego mind. I call it the ego mind. I don't like to talk about ego, because that gives the idea there's something, there's some entity inside us, something called ego. But there's no thing there. There's just a mindset. There's a way of looking at the world that we get caught in. And so I think Buddha's realization was when we let go of the clinging, when we cease the clinging, when we cease to follow those thoughts we get stuck in, when we cease to follow those thoughts, then we're stepping out of the ego mind. We're coming back to whatever you want to call it, our authentic self, our being, our true essence. And what I like about seeing it this way is it makes liberation, which is really, you know, the goal of all Buddha's teachings was liberation, freedom, but liberation. It's not some far off goal. And so often I hear this in teachings, you're like, if you do this, do that, do this, then basically at the end of all this, you'll get liberated. I see it not as some far off goal, but it's something we can touch into, we can taste any time, really. We can have a taste of it anytime we just choose to let go of our thinking, come back, as we've been doing in the meditations, just coming back to that sense of, ah, here I am. That's that liberation from being caught in the whirling of mind stuff. So that I think is what, you know, that's what the Buddha was experiencing clearly, is that letting go of clinging, how that was. And then the fourth noble truth is what's often called the Eightfold Path, which again is traditionally interpreted as, you know, these are the steps you have to take in order to get liberated. And I found a quote here I found the other day, which I think is, where is it? So perfect. Yes, the Eightfold Path to Nirvana, in which an aspirant must become practiced in right views, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Do all that and you will be liberated. That's the sort of background idea that's going on here. What I've been doing is exploring a very different interpretation of this. And it's not to say that all the classic interpretations of Buddhism are wrong. There's so much value in that. I don't want to in any way, be saying they're wrong, but it's just another view that I've been playing with, which I find useful in my own life. So the Eightfold Path, the word is marga, which means way, in a way, in the same sense as, you know, the Tao Te Ching is the way. We talk about the way, and the classic interpretation is it's the way to liberation. But I've been looking at it more is it's the way of liberation. It's what happens to what is what happens as you awaken. It's an unfolding of the awakening. It's a description of the awakening. And again, it's called the Noble Eightfold Path. This is noble. It's how the wise ones see it. And the first element is right view. And again, the conventional approach is that you have to, you know, adopt the right perception. You have to see that, you know, have to accepting that life is impermanent, that all, you know, but all life is sacred, and in some traditions, you know, death is not the end, and you might have to accept karma, there's consequence. It's a whole sort of set of view of the world. But to me, you know, the view of the wise ones, the noble ones, the views of the wise ones, the liberated ones who've already stepped out of the ego mind, is they're spontaneously, automatically in the right view. The liberated person sees things as they are because their mind is no longer clouded by all the machinations of our egoic thinking. They've let go of that perspective, that sort of egoic perspective, what I've got to do, worry about this, worry about that. They've let go of that. So they're naturally seeing things as they are. They're naturally in right view. And so it's not that the right view leads to liberation, but the right view comes from liberation. This is what I've been exploring in all these bits of the Eightfold Path is, you know, do we sometimes put the cart before the horse? You know, the horse is the awakening and the cart is what it brings with it. But so often I think we see the cart, we see what the awakening is, and we think, oh, I've got to do that, I've got to give up this. If awakened people aren't so attached to things, I've got to not be attached to things. I think in some ways we get it back to front. And this is the second way is right thought, or sometimes said right intention. But again, I think this can follow. If someone's already awake, then their thinking is not clouded by the views of the ego mind. They're already free from that. I mean, in classic views, it said, you know, part of the right thinking is, you know, not to do any harm, the intent to do no harm. But if you turn it around the other way, it may not be so much there is intent to do no harm, so much as there is no intent to do harm. I mean, it's subtle, but to me, it's a very profound thinking, shift in thinking. And I just think, you know, with more and more was exploring non-dual teachings, I think this approach to it, I think for me, is much more meaningful, much more realistic in my own life. I don't want to spend 20 years doing all these other things in the hope I might get liberated. It's more the practice is coming back to that, finding that in oneself day by day, tasting that. And the same as we go on through the others, right speech, right speech is speech that causes no harm. And again, it's the ego mind that starts causing harm to others. It's the ego mind that judges other people. It's the ego mind that maybe wants to attack someone verbally or criticize them verbally, or the ego mind that wants to say, look at me, I know, I'm right. So again, I think if, you know, someone who's already ceased that clinging, the third step, I think is naturally going to be more attuned to just speaking without harm, speaking right. In fact, it was one of Buddha's definitions was of right speech was, or one of the ways he put it was, if you can't say something without the other person feeling hurt, then it's better to retain noble silence. And then there's other things about right speech, which I'm sure a lot of us know, is that the question we can have when we're saying anything is, I think there's four ingredients or four criteria which people often comment on or say, which is one, is it true? Is it useful? Is it timely? And is it kind, as things to bear in mind? But then as we go on, I see the same thing with the other elements. I don't see them as steps or stages or practices. I see them as the elements of awakening. The next one is, you know, right, what we say, wise action, the action of wise people. And the same, I think if we're free from that ego motivation to start with, then our actions are naturally going to be wiser, be more, if you like, be more right, be more correct. And with right, the fifth one is right livelihood, how we live our lives. I think the same sort of thing applies. And then the last three get particularly interesting for me, right effort or wise effort. Remember, this is the view of the wise person. I keep coming back to this is how the wise person sees it, the wise person who's awoken. In fact, that's what the word Buddha means, literally, just the one who has awoken. So the way the wise people see it is, it's not about putting a lot of effort, put a lot of trying to control things. In meditation particularly, as you know, in my approach, I encourage no effort whatsoever. It's really allowing the mind to relax, and any effort we put into it is actually doing the opposite, is creating more tension in the mind. But I think it's also about how we act in the world, how we flow in the world. Again, it's this, you know, sukha is about flowing in the world without resistance. So I like to think of it more as, right effort is relaxed intention. We have intention, but instead of going at it and forcibly trying to change things, just more relaxed about it, allowing things to flow. And I always find in my life, the more I allow things to flow, the better it is. I mean, I had something earlier this week. I was thinking I should call somebody to sort something out and didn't quite know what to do about it. And this voice just said, leave it. And half an hour later, I got a message from somebody and everything had totally changed, the situation had totally changed. I didn't need to do anything. But it's that sort of, that's what I mean. It's not about we got to keep doing and controlling the world, but it's about stepping back and taking a more relaxed approach to things. And then the seventh one is right meditation, right mindfulness. It's often translated as, as I mentioned before, for me is about not following the thoughts, catching the sprouting as it occurs, and coming back to that authentic self, returning, as I put it two months ago now, returning to natural mind, returning to that natural great peace. But it's about removing the veils to it. We don't create peaceful states of mind. We remove the veils to the peaceful state of mind. And that again is the shift. And the word sati, that's often translated as mindfulness, literally in Sanskrit and in Pali, means actually to remember. So I see mindfulness is remembering our true nature. It's not remembering as an idea who we are, as some understanding, some idea, but just coming back, reconnecting with our own essence, reconnecting with our own being. And the final one is right samadhi, which is translated as right concentration. But again, that gets so easily misinterpreted, I think, as you've got to concentrate the mind. You've got to, really control the mind, keep it focused. I mean, you can do that, but it's very, very hard. It's the way it's actually defined, samadhi, it's the mind that has come together, it's collected together, and it's defined as the still mind. It's the mind that's just resting in being. So it's not actually an instruction to concentrate the mind in that deliberate way. It's more, as I say, the mind or the attention becoming concentrated in being. It's like, I think of it as concentrated orange juice. It's like, it's the essence of it. Concentrated orange juice is the essence of orange juice. It's the concentrated mind is the mind that is just, it's become concentrated in its essence, concentrated in its true nature. And that is the mind that is, it's settled, it's clear, it's what comes again from letting go of clinging. And, some Buddhists describe it as the state of the great perfection. Perfection means nothing more can be added. It's not like there's no blemishes. It's like nothing more can be added. And that to me is why it's called nirvana. Nirvana literally means blowing out the flame of desire. In that state, there's nothing, I'm sure some of you have known this in meditation, when you're deep in meditation, deep in that quiet state, it's like, why would I want anything else? There's nothing to be added to this. And there's that sense of freedom. This is the liberation that Buddha was talking about, the inner liberation, the freedom. And every time we let go a little, we have a little taste of that freedom, whether it's just a sense of relief or greater ease or greater quietness, whatever it is, we are tasting that liberation he was talking about. We don't every time we pause our thinking, we don't drop into complete enlightenment, no, but we are tasting tasting that awakening. And the more we taste it, the more there's that motivation to continue that way. So I just give that as that sort of the way I've been exploring and playing with it. I know it's very unconventional, and devout Buddhist teachers may say I'm totally wrong, I don't get it. And I know, you know, if you look at Buddhist texts, it's clear, very, very clear, that part of what Buddha was teaching was about you need to, you know, see things the right way, think the right way, you need to speak the right way, etc. That's clearly there. But there's the other view as well. And in fact, I know some Buddhist teachers who see it both ways. They see it both as this is what you need to do as the path to awakening, but also the other way around, that this is a description of how awakening unfolds. This is the way of awakening, the way it unfolds. And as I just find it I just find it more pertinent for me, more relevant to my life. So I'm not dissing the traditional view. I'm just saying here's an interpretation which I really like, and it's valuable for me. And I think, you know, I may have mentioned this before, I think what happens with any, not any awakening person, but most people when they, quote, wake up, is they find life is so much more delightful, enjoyable, they're at ease, that they want to share it with other people. And that's what the Buddha happened to the Buddha. You know, he woke up and it's like, wow, hey, this is the way. And so he goes off excitedly to his friends. And he sort of tells them, you know, hey, you know, what we, you know, of course we're all discontent, but, it, you know, it, what happens, it comes from clinging. We have to let go of clinging. And then what I've discovered is, you know, this is when that happens, this is how you see things, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think he was clearly, you know, we accept he was a fully awakened person. And he talked about there is no self. He'd seen there is no self in the sense of no individual, separate, personal self. And so he'd have been talking from that perspective of seeing there is no self. And so I think he would have been expressing the view that I've been talking about here as well. Like, this is how it is. This is how it is when you wake up. But what happens with, I think, every spiritual teaching that comes up like this is the people who are listening are not awakened. So they're listening from the unawakened state, wanting to be awakened, but misinterpreting it from the, or not misinterpreting, but interpreting it from the unawakened point of view. And like, this is what we've got to do, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the awakened perspective, which is, you know, just about coming back, touching into, you know, reconnecting with our being, is what Rupert Spira calls the direct path, gets forgotten, gets ignored, because the existing culture doesn't have the sort of the way to see it that way. It wants to see things in a dualistic way. And so I think that interpretation of teachings gets lost, gets forgotten. And so that's really what I've been playing with myself, just how do we come back to that more non-dual approach. Anyway, I've been spouting on for a good time now. So the way we take questions here, oh no, let's do a meditation. I forgot. I always like to do a meditation on this. So let's just do a short meditation. What I've been doing in the meditations in the previous sessions, in the first one, it's mindfulness of being. We're looking at the aspect of being, which is the I am, the I amness, the self. And the second one, we're looking at the joy, you know, how the enjoyment of the natural great peace. So this one, I just want to look more at the freedom side. So what I always like to do in this, I'll turn my video off just because it allows me to be more internal leading a meditation. And everybody wants to turn their video off just while we do this, just feel free. And I'll just take us through a short meditation on this. So if you would just like to just close your eyes if you want. You don't have to, but I find it's easier for most of us. Close our eyes. And always start by just taking a few deeper breaths. Just breathing out is just a sign. It's just a sign to the body, really, the sign to our being that everything's okay. There's nothing to worry about. We can begin to relax. Everything's okay. And just feel that relaxation in the body. And just as we do that, just noticing our experience in the moment as we come back to our actual experience in the moment. What's happening now? What are we, sounds around us, sensations in the body, background feelings that may be there, little thoughts coming in. Really just allowing the mind to relax as well. And for me, allowing the mind to relax is allowing the attention to relax, allowing the attention to soften. Normally we're focused in on something. Our attention is focused on whatever it is of interest or what we need to be doing. So we're zoomed in. As I've said before, I like to think of this as zooming out, just a more open, relaxed awareness. And just noticing how that feels in us. And in this, just noticing any sense of that sort of greater sense of freedom or liberation that we're just tasting. Just a taste of that as we just let the attention relax, just tasting that sense of freedom inside. And as always, the mind, the attention is going to wander off on some thought that it thinks is interesting. That happens to everybody. We're not trying to stop thought, but we're like stopping the sprouting or not letting it continue to sprout. So whenever you notice a thought sprouting, just choosing not to follow it anymore for now, making that choice not to follow the thought. And just letting the attention coming back to being in this moment. Know where we're trying to get to. We're already here. So nothing we need to do. Any doing is just going to take us away from just simply being here now. And just noticing how that is, whatever it is for you. But for most people, there's usually some sense of greater ease, relief, release, lightness of being, sense of spaciousness, whatever. Different things for different people. However it is for you. And just noticing that taste of freedom that is there, just that taste of freedom. That taste of liberation that comes when we cease clinging to a particular thought or idea. So let's just sit for another moment, minute or so, just enjoying this sense of ease and freedom that comes from not getting caught up in our thoughts. And when we do get caught up in another one, just choosing not to follow it for the moment. Okay, so we went off a bit longer today. We still got time. We can run over time for any questions or comments or anything. The way that we've been doing this in the past is, because there's quite a number of people on, is to submit any questions you might have to Linda in the chat, and then she can, sometimes, you know, several have the same question or whatever. But also, because when I'm busy, you know, talking to someone, answering questions, I don't want to divide my attention to seeing who else has got their hand up or who's in the chat. I just like to be able to just be with the person I'm talking to and not have to be managing the whole thing as well. Linda, do you want to say anything on that? Nope.
You can put your note in the chat if you want. And if you can't seem to see the chat, I put a note in there to put it in and I'll see it. If you raise your hand, I can see you all on the screen. So right. I prefer to start with it in the writing, but please, whatever you need to do to get heard, I'll watch for you. Right. There's one in the chat right now, if we want to begin, Pete, on please elaborate on effortlessness. And then I see... Bajakman waving her hand, so I could always call on them after.
So what was the question on effortlessness? You say, was it?
Please elaborate on effortlessness.
Right. Particularly, I mean, in meditation, which is where I've been sort of teaching it mostly, we fall into the trap, which is, I think, indoctrinated into us in our society. It's like, the harder you try, the better. If you're not succeeding, try harder. And that, you know, that may well be the case in, you know, certain things in the world. It may well be true that, you know, the harder we try, the better. But in meditation, it's certainly not the case in my experience. It's so easy, though, because we have this in our, you know, conditioning. It's so easy, even when we know meditation is about letting the mind relax, about no effort, it's so easy for it to creep in. It's like, well, maybe if I just did this, I could improve it. It's like that the trying keeps creeping in some little way, or the wishing it were better. I had an experience several years ago now, which really, I mean, taught me a lot. It was just an instant thing. I was sitting in my meditation and it wasn't as good as the day before. I had some, you know, days, and it was just like feeling it. This wasn't quite such a deep meditation. And I was, you know, thinking about what I was not doing, what I could do to make it better. And then just suddenly it just occurred to me, this is the way it is. I wasn't accepting the present moment. I was just not accepting that this is how the moment is. And as soon as I did that, it's like And in this moment, the meditation is not as deep. And here I am wondering about how to make it deeper and all that stuff. As soon as I just accepted all that, everything dropped away. And it's like, ah, here I am. I just realized that slight, even wanting something to be better, not accepting things totally as they are, that slight resistance gets in the way of just completely dropping back into our own beingness. And in terms of life, I find in many ways things happen despite my trying. There's, you know, so much of the important things that have happened in my life have been completely synchronistic. Things happen that just doors open. It was synchronicity that has actually led my life much more than my effort, my trying. So what I was suggesting is, in life, yes, there are times when we need to put effort into things, certainly, but also to try and practice a more relaxed intention is, this is how I would like to see things, but rather going at it hammer and nails, making it happen, holding the attention and just taking it a more relaxed approach and moving with the flow more.
That takes to another question that somebody wanted to kind of refine. Is attention, not per definition, effortless versus concentration?
Is attention
not per definition effortless, right, versus concentration? Okay.
Attention literally means to move towards something. That's what it literally means. So our attention is like the spotlight of consciousness. The way I see it is, in my consciousness, you know, right this moment, I have what I'm seeing, what I'm hearing, my feelings, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then there's the spotlight of attention, which is, where is my interest at the moment? So the attention is like the spotlight, you know, and it may be on, you know, the screen at the moment, or thinking about what I'm saying, or whatever it is. The attention is like, what is the spotlight of my consciousness at the moment? And that in itself doesn't involve any effort. And a lot of the time, our attention just wanders around. You know, I hear a bird singing, and my attention may go to that sound. Or I feel an itch, my attention may go to the itch. It's drawn around to points of interest. So it doesn't in itself imply effort. Paying attention, in our culture, we talk about paying attention. That often does. It implies holding the attention. Pay attention to, you know, what you're doing, or pay attention to this sound. It means holding the attention to something. So there's two modes of attention. There's holding the attention to something, or there's the relaxed attention of the attention just being relaxed and just following points of interest that come up. And so in meditation, it's that relaxed mode of intention we're encouraging, rather than the paying attention. But so often that paying attention mode gets brought into the meditation. That's where a lot of the concentration practices come from.
So let me see if somebody, I have a couple more questions in the chat, but I noticed that somebody, I don't know your first name, M.A. Bajakman.
Oh, M.A., I know M.A. from 30 years ago. How long ago? M.A. will tell me, I remember.
So I don't know if she had a question, but I saw her raising her hand earlier. So you can unmute yourself and say something. Oh, okay.
That was M.A.? You there, M.A.?
I am.
Good. Can't see you, but.
I'm on my screen. I'm in the corner.
Okay.
Two squares below me. So good to see you,
Peter. Your screen is always different from mine. Okay. Ah, now I can see you. There you are. Hello.
Hello, Peter.
40 years back. Okay.
Really? And my daughter's on here also. She's Kim Bjarkman. She has a picture of her cat, I think.
How lovely.
So did you want to some comment or question, M.A.?
I'm complete.
Ah.
I'm full. I'm in a state of attention.
Thank you. Good to see you and be in touch with you.
Okay, so I've got a couple of more things. I'm gonna come to James in a minute and Andrea. So first I had Pupak said, what is the connection between the mind and body and how does the spirit come into the picture of the awakening? And then I've got about three more questions. So okay. Pace yourself.
Read Pupak's again. What is the connection between mind
and body? What is the connection between the mind and body? And how does the spirit come into the picture of the awakening?
Right. The connection of mind and body, there's different ways of looking at this. I mean, mind is what we are experiencing. That's the way I use mind. Mind is the totality of my conscious experience. So, you know, right now it's everything that's going on in my world. That's mind. It's mind is subjective experience. And the body is the physical vehicle in the world. And the senses, the sense organs are part of that physical vehicle. And the sense organs feed the mind. All my images, whatever I'm seeing, hearing, is coming from the body. It's going, the brain is processing it all. And the brain is creating this representation of what is out there. And then magic happens. And this is the bit that nobody knows. I mean, I've got my own ideas, different people have their ideas. I've almost given up thinking about it now. Magic happens, that somehow all this processing in the brain, in the body, this experience arises in the mind. How that happens, what the relationship is, my feeling is we're all on the wrong track. We created some false separation here in terms of trying to explain how mind arises out of the body. My own view, I won't go into it now, you can actually find lots of things of mine on YouTube on it, on the reality of consciousness, is that everything is ultimately consciousness, if you like, spirit, and the material world arises, our perception of the material world arises within it. That's a whole complex thing, which I won't go into now. So spirit, for me, spirit, I use spirit really in the same sense of mind. Spirit is, it means vapor, literally. It's that which is not seen. It's not the physical world. The spirit is the non-physical world. So for me, the spiritual is the spiritual, whatever it is, process, awakening, is the exploration of consciousness. That's the real essence of spirituality, the exploration of consciousness.
Okay, I've got a bunch of other things. Let's go. I think I'm going to have enough questions to end this, so I want to just get
we can run over a bit if we need to.
A couple of people put some things in a chat to you, but I'm going to, I think you just defined your idea of the mind. So I hope that's a good enough answer for Dr. Gilbert. Andrea A. asked, do you think that there is only one real truth? Or is that too broad?
No. Yes and no. There's no one real truth in the relative world. And by that I mean, you know, in terms of ideas, philosophies, you know, what we're seeing, you know, my truth is filtered by my past, my senses, by my mindset. My truth is filtered by me and shaped by me and my experience. Whatever truth I come to is, you know, I just want to say there's 7 billion different truths in this world. So in the relative sense, I don't think there's a single truth. In what you might call the absolute truth, yes. And that truth is consciousness. Basically, that the truth that we are aware, this is the one undeniable truth. My being, my beingness, that I am here. And that's what Descartes was getting at, the philosopher. He was looking for absolute truth. And he was looking for it, for start, in the relative world. And he sat down one night to see if there was any, he had his process of doubt. He thought whatever is absolutely true must be beyond doubt. And he went through in his mind anything he could not doubt. He found he could doubt his experience, he could doubt his ideas, he could doubt his philosophies, he could doubt what he was seeing. Maybe there was a demon in his mind, you know, creating all this stuff. What he could not doubt was that he was doubting in a way. He could not doubt that he was thinking, that he was experiencing. And so his final statement was, cogito ergo sum, because I am thinking, therefore the one thing I cannot doubt is that I am. So that to me is the absolute truth. That's what Descartes was pointing to. The absolute truth is I am, is one way of putting it. I am conscious, there is awareness. That is a truth that we all share and cannot doubt.
Great. Now I've got two people who put a question in the chat to you, and if it's James and Avon, we're short on time, James and Avon, but would James unmute himself? And if it's a fairly quick question, we could probably James get to it.
James always has good questions.
No, I just wanted to make a comment on your overall presentation, because it sounds like the whole process of liberation is a kind of practice of non-doing, in terms that we kind of surrender to our practice with the eyes open and eyes closed. We evolve naturally to enjoy all of the qualities that you describe. So there's no sort of striving or actually beating ourselves up. We just simply practice, enjoy the awareness. And when we've lost the awareness, we come back to it and we kind of trust in the natural process. That's one of the things I've noticed myself, is that the longer I practice, I can get knowledge in certain things, but it's not a question of saying, well, I have to be that. It just seems to come about itself, but you have to be patient. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. I think this is something more and more of us are learning. Yeah, which is good. That's what I feel is fascinating about these times, is we're honing in on the ultimate truth collectively. More and more people are recognizing the simplicity of it all. We've made it so complex in the past, but now with, you know, more and more, you know, good awakened people around, teachers, you know, we can chat to each other. I think we're gradually just stripping away all those trappings that have been added on in the past, and just getting down to the simple essence. And it just, the simpler it gets, the easier it gets. That's my feeling. And just in my, and not just mean collectively, in my own experience, you know, sometimes often on a meditation retreat, when I'm, you know, really quiet, it's like, I go, oh, it's this simple. Oh, it's this simple. It's like peeling away layers of the onion. You think you got to the center of the onion. It's like, no, there's some more layers to peel away. Yeah. Thanks, James.
Okay. And Avon, can you unmute yourself and ask your question? And then we have one other question after that, and we're set.
Avon?
Yes, this is Avon. First of all, Pete, this is not a question, it's one of gratitude. Your reinterpretation of the Four Noble Truths and your translation from the original language just resonate completely. What it does for me is it emphasizes that our true innate nature is always present, and that one's choice or attention in each moment is that effortless, as you call it, taste of freedom, and a moment of awareness of what is always true and present. So a bow of gratitude to you.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to see you. Well, good to hear you and see your picture. Yes, thank you. Yeah. But again, I was saying to James, I think this is, we're all beginning to move in this direction. I think this is the collective discovery we're making.
Well, and this kind of plays into it. This is CJ asked, as time passes, what accounts for the conviction that we are the same person? As time passes, yes. What accounts for the conviction that we are the same person?
Well, my answer is always yes and no. In some senses, we aren't the same person. If we look at our individual personal self, you know, if I look at, you know, my values and how I see the world and what I think is important, where I am today from where I was you know, 30, 40 years ago, I'm different. In that sense, I'm a different person, in that very personal, in that sense of the individual I that I am. But the, I think what you're referring to is that deeper sense of, you know, what in the first session we just called the I amness, and that's the truth that I was pointing to earlier, that basic truth, the I amness, that never changes. You know, how that feeling of, you know, it's the I that is aware of this, the I that is, even the I that is aware of my personality and all my history, that sense of I never changes. What it's aware of changes, but that sense of being, it's really that sense of being, which we label I, is that, it's that sense of being aware, that, you know we are aware, and that feeling, we don't really have the words for this. The best I can put it is that feeling of being aware, we label I, we call that I. And so the awareness is always present. Awareness itself never changes. What appears in awareness is always changing, but awareness itself never changes. That being aware never changes. So that deepest sense of I, that me, the I am, our beingness, is always the same. It has to be. So it isn't that something keeps it the same, but it is inevitably always the same, that deep sense of I am. Although, you know, the personal self, we have to distinguish that deep sense of I am from the personal self, you know, I am Peter Russell, blah, 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 blah. That changes, but not that deep sense of awareness. So it's really, it's just the name, that I is the name we give, the label we give to being aware.
And the very last thing, are you holding any online meditation courses? And I thought maybe you could take a second and talk a little bit about your book that's coming out, and then we can.
Thank you.
Sorry if that's putting you on the spot.
Linda's always up for helping me, promoting me. Thank you. I have an online meditation course called How to Meditate Without Even Trying, which is it's not a personal course, not a live course. It's a recorded course which you subscribe to, and you get sent lessons each week. The nearest I'm doing to online course is this, really. I thought of doing an online meditation course, but I thought I'd just get bored by that. I wanted to do more talking and things. And so discussing this with Linda over, you know, December, Christmas, she decided the way to do it was more this presentation. So this is the only stuff I'm doing live at the moment. And what was the other part of the question? Oh, the book. You want me to? Yes. Some of you know I've got a new book coming out in August. Early August, called Letting Go of Nothing. And some of it is what I've been talking about here, but a lot of what I'm talking about here isn't in the book. It's really seeing letting go as the key thing in just about every spiritual tradition in one way or another. And what we're letting go of aren't things. We're not, you know, whatever we want to let go of, whether, you know, it's some money issue or a relationship or something else or some, I don't know, whatever it is, some possession. What we're letting go of is our attitude, our assumption, our beliefs about it. And they're not things. In fact, what we're really letting go of, ultimately, we're letting go of the ego mindset. And the mindset isn't a thing. It's not even a thing we can identify in the mind. It's just a way of looking at things. So what we're letting go of is no things. That's where it comes from. We're letting go of nothing, but also we're letting go to nothing. And there's various puns on that. But that, yeah, that's the book. Thank you. Thank you, Linda. I always mention it. I'll probably do a session at some stage near the publication on letting go. Yeah. Great. Anything else?
Not that I have. If anybody has a very quick last minute thing they want to raise their hand for. I'll call on you.
Great. Nope.
And I could unmute everybody just to say thank you if they want, so you can hear everybody's voice. And then I think we're set.
Just to mention, as I mentioned in the email, you know, obviously I don't charge for any of this, but anybody who wants to, you know, give some donation, some support, whatever, it's in the email that went out, or it's on the Mindfulness of Being site, how you can do that. It's
all. I also just put that in the chat, and all you have to go do is go to PayPal and go to Elf Rock Productions in PayPal. But there's a link on the email too. Actually, it's not in the email, Peter. It's on the web page.
Right. Okay. So yeah, thank you. I want to unmute everybody who's left, and we can just say hi and bye.